Welcome to Elevate, the podcast where trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravapudi talk about the real issues that come with the fight for justice. So let's find inspiration in the wins. Let's learn from the losses. But most of all, let's keep learning and getting better and keep getting back in the ring. Are you ready to elevate your own trial practice, law firm, and life? Let's get started. Produced and powered by LawPods.
Hey, it's Ben. Raul and I started this podcast because we love hanging out with fellow trial lawyers and sharing ideas that can make us all better. And both of our firms also regularly collaborate with other lawyers across the countries in cases where we can add value. If you're interested in collaboration, or even if you just have a case or an idea that you want to bounce off us or brainstorm, Raul and I are going to be hosting confidential case workshops the first Wednesday of each month. So here's how it works. If you have a case or an idea that you want to talk about or brainstorm with us, just send me an email to ben@elevate.net, E-L-A-W-V-A-T-E.net, or go online to elevate.net and submit a case workshop request. We will schedule you for a confidential 30-minute Zoom meeting where we can talk about your case to see if we can help. If you feel like there would be good value in collaborating on the case further, we can talk about that. If not, that's okay too. We enjoy helping other trial lawyers because we know someday you'd be willing to do the same for us if we needed your help. So again, if you're interested in workshopping your case with us, just send an email to ben@elevate.net or fill out a case workshop request at elevate.net. And Rahul and I will look forward to chatting with you soon. Today's episode of the Elevate podcast is brought to you by Filevine. Filevine has a software program called Lead Docket, which is the gold standard for managing your new case intakes and leads, your Glengarry leads, your Glenn Gross leads, and all of your other leads. So check them out at Filevine and manage your leads. We're also brought to you by Steno. Rahul, you guys work with Steno.
Steno is the best in court reporting services, not just in court reporting services, but even some of their technology tools. We're talking about AI a little bit on this podcast and their transcript genius, where they can summarize and take interrogatories based on deposition transcripts, is so useful. If you haven't tried it, definitely try it.
We're brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal does digital marketing, web development for trial firms. It's owned by our good friends, Micah and Tyler. They recently redeveloped our firm's website, so you can check our website out. If you like it, give them a call and they can help you out too. And finally, we're brought to you by Expert Institute. Rahul, you guys work with them, right?
We both use Expert Institute because you always need to be cutting edge in the experts that we use in our cases. Going to the repeat experts every single time is going to make you a lesser lawyer. And you always want to keep up. And the best way to do that is with Expert Institute.
For more than 4 years, you've helped us elevate the practice of law. Now we're ready to take on the business of law. Say hello to the new podcast from the Elevate team. Build and grow your law firm. Enjoy this special preview episode.
It's like Rachel was saying, thank you very much. This is the first time they're doing it, first time we're doing a live podcast. So keep your fingers crossed and we're excited. So welcome to a live taping of the Elevate Build and Grow Your Law Firm podcast. We're coming to you from the Maine State Bar Association Winter Bar Conference and the fantastic Westin Portland Harbor View in Portland, Maine. I'm Jeff Wright, Chief Operating Officer at Gideon Aeson, and I'm here with Ben Gideon, owner, partner, founder of Gideon Aeson. How's it going today, Ben?
It's going well, Jeff. Are you nervous? You were commenting that the lights are awfully bright, and I know you're now entering the big time here. So
yeah, big time. That's one way to put it. I would like to point out...
Jeff has humble roots.
Yeah. I'd like to point out that Ben said we were dressing down today, and so I wore jeans and a pullover, and Ben showed up in what looks like a brand new suit. So apologies for my appearance. I was duped.
This is a common theme in our business.
But as I pointed out, since you're not a lawyer, you don't really need to wear a suit. You're not expected to wear a suit.
I do love how you point out how I'm not a lawyer all the time, but that's okay.
I consider that an advantage.
It is, but we won't go there. Before we get started, we've had a busy couple weeks, so I don't know if you want to kind of talk about what we've been doing as a firm, and then we can introduce the show.
Yeah, sure. So we just got back from our leadership retreat, 3 days out in Denver, Colorado, where we, the leadership team, focuses on our goals that we've, what we've achieved for the past year, and then what our plan is for the future year. Very productive meeting. I think we identified some important goals and keeping our progress moving towards our four-year vision. What did you think?
Yeah, I thought it was very productive out in Denver. And then one of the things, and we'll talk about it later, is that the firm, we try and have as much transparency as possible with the entire team. So a week after we got back from our senior management retreat in Denver, we had an all-day offsite retreat for all staff and covered our strategic plan, our goals, our plans for not only first quarter of 26, but for the year up through our strategic plan end date at the end of 2028. It's nice. It's been a busy couple weeks. I think you left out that you were skiing in Austria before that.
I was, but that doesn't have anything to do with our business.
No, it doesn't.
Now, we did manage to get to a rodeo in Denver, which was interesting. I don't know if anyone here has been to the rodeo in the West, but they have something called mutton busting. Anyone aware of that? It's where they take little kids and they put hockey helmets on them and put them on sheep. And then they go and, like, you know, it's like a bucking bronco, but for infants and children. It seems like child abuse to me, but they love it out there. We're going to introduce that in Maine, I think.
Okay.
All right, let's move into the substance of the program here.
All right. So we have a pretty truncated time frame. So we have 10 topics we want to get through in less than an hour. Each one of these topics would be a full hour unto themselves. So we're going to be as quick and concise as possible. As Rachel said, this program today is the top 10 proven strategies every lawyer entrepreneur needs to know to build a financially successful law firm. At the end of this, they have allotted us time when we're done with the podcast to do a Q&A. So I would welcome anyone that has a question or anything or needs more clarity on something at the end. We will do a Q&A if anyone's interested. I know it's the last session of the day and most people will be running for the hills, but we are available.
Yeah, you can come up and sit at the table with the mic and you can join us on the podcast and introduce yourselves. And if you have a question or want to take issue with anything we've said or any discussion point, we're happy to do that at the end. So, Jeff, I thought before we covered the topics, can you just give us maybe the 30-second summary of where we are as a firm so people understand the context from which we're discussing the points we're talking about today?
You know, for those of you not familiar with Gideon Easton, I'm going to give you kind of the Reader's Digest version and paint a picture on what makes these guys think they can get up here and give their opinions and advice on what makes a financially viable, successful firm. So Gideon Easton, as most of you know, is a plaintiff firm focused on complex medical malpractice and catastrophic personal injury. The firm was started in 2020 by Ben Gideon and Taylor Asen, the other founder partner. And really, it started in 2020 with three of them. Since 2020, the firm has grown not only in staffing, but also in revenue, where the firm from 2020 to 2024 added more than $1 million in revenue every year in existence. At the end of 2024, Ben and the leadership team met and they said, well, geez, we've met all our goals from what we wanted to do to start the firm. And somebody said, so what's next? And so the team took that to heart and wrote a very detailed 4-year strategic plan. And one of the first things on that plan was to bring in a chief operating officer, preferably a chief operating officer that did not have a legal background that could look at a firm from a business standpoint and not through the eyes of an attorney, that chief operating officer happens to be me. And I started in... The jury's still out. I started in January of 2025. So I've been there roughly, well, a little over 12 months now. In 2025, which we just ended, we were able to increase our revenue by 100%. And we've increased our staffing by 50%. We've gone from 12 full-time employees to 18, and our revenue doubled this year. Coming off of our strategic plan, we plan on adding two or three more positions this year, and we are projected, based upon our pipeline and everything, to double our revenue again in 2026. So we want to talk about some of the strategies that we've implemented and that we think firms that are looking to grow and expand and or people that are looking to start their own firms could have some benefit from.
All right, let's jump into it.
All right. So, number one, everyone should have a handout on their tables. If you don't, we do have more back there. And the first one, Ben, I guess my first question, Ben, is how did you come up with these 10 things and kind of the title of this program?
The 10 items here are all, so my process in trying to understand how to build and grow a law firm, I started probably like many of you as a lawyer only for many years. I had a job at a firm and I practiced law. That was my primary work. And I didn't really spend a lot of time focused on learning much about running a business or running a law firm. When we started our business, I've invested a lot of time in, and I've become very interested in the topics of the business issues relating to building and growing a firm. And part of that has been reading. So I've read a lot of books. I listen to podcasts, but some of the books that were most informative and influential for me are listed here under each topic. And what my process is, I'll read one of these books, and as I do it, I take notes, and then I consolidate those down. And then over time, I've moved those into different categories. And so that's sort of how the 10 categories came to be. It's a distillation of my learning, I would say both from my reading, but also from our own experiences that we've gone through, mostly learning by trial and error, making many mistakes, fixing problems, and coming to understandings about different things.
Well, kicking into number one, the crux of your thing there is being a great lawyer doesn't necessarily translate to being a great owner of your own firm. And I guess, you know, why do you feel that way? And why do you use the word entrepreneur kind of in the title of this, which I think is important?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that took me a little bit of time to come to. I don't know, has anyone here read Michael Gerber's book, The E-Myth? The central concept of the book is that you can either work in a business or you can work on a business. If you're working in a business, you're doing the tasks that are necessary to make that business successful. So as lawyers, we're, you know, typically what we're doing every day is legal work and practicing law and serving our clients. That's great. I did that for a long time. I got a lot of joy and satisfaction out of it, and I still do to some extent. If you want to build a business, though, you can't just work in your business. You have to work on your business. And that's a different skill set. That involves, in fact, it means you have to give up a fair amount of the day-to-day legal work and focus on the business issues relating to building and growing the business, which we'll get into. So it's sort of that core insight that, to some extent, by training yourself to focus only on doing legal work, you're not in a great mindset to build a business. We have a whole episode just on this topic, and It can consume an hour or more. But I do distinguish between, there are many lawyers who very successfully translate their legal skills to a very successful practice, building a solo or a small practice with a couple of lawyers and a few staff. That's not what I mean. I think that that's very doable, even if you're not really focused on the issues relating to business development and scaling. When I'm talking about building a business, and that's why the word entrepreneurial is important to me, I'm talking about building an entrepreneurial business that's designed for growth, because those are two very different things. Having a platform where you're just using a business as a foundation to sell your own personal services, that's not what I mean by growing a business, because there's very limited business-related skill sets you need to do to accomplish that successfully. And I don't mean to minimize that. I think that can be a very successful career and practice, and many people do very well like that. And that's fine. There's no reason you need to change.
But the goal, if somebody wants to build and scale a business.
Right. And I guess I would ask you, Jeff, since you've been here a year now and you came in midstream from a different sector, brand new to the legal business, how do you see your role and your past experience in business integrating into a legal setting?
I was surprised.
You should tell people what you used to do before this, just so they know.
Well, they're probably going to hold it against me. I was a banker for 25 years.
We like bankers.
You like bankers? You figured that? This is the way. I've tried to shed the look. But so I was in banking for 25 years, kind of climbed the ladder. My last role was a chief operating officer of a $1 billion bank. And long story short, I got sick of banking and wanted to change, but thought my operational skills, my project management skills, and everything were translatable to another business. Didn't know what business it was. Saw the opportunity. A recruiter reached out to me at Gideon Aisin, and I was trepidatious because I'm like, okay, it's a plaintiff firm. What does that mean? I was literally like, how does that differ from a defense firm? Or what do they do? And it's personal injury. And I'm like, how is it going to translate? And do they really want a non-attorney? And I think this might sound arrogant, but I think it's probably one of the better decisions they made is to bring in somebody that knew nothing about the legal world. Because I look at everything through a completely different set of eyes. And the skills are very translatable to building and scaling a business and working with business owners. You know, over the last two decades, it doesn't matter whether it's an attorney or whether it's, you know, somebody starting a car wash business. The scale and the concerns that every small business owner has are translatable. And Ben had said to me during the interview process, he said, most law firms are run by attorneys and they run like law firms, Jeff. They don't run like businesses. We need to translate this into running like a business.
Does that mean, growth?
We're supposed to repeat the questions because they won't pick up on the mic. So the question from the audience is, does that mean growth? Jeff, why don't you take that?
I don't know if it necessarily means growth. I mean, I think first of all, you have to look how the business is run. Whether your ultimate goal is going to be growth, one of the first things we worked on was the firm's mission and the firm's culture. What type of firm do we want to be? What do we want our attorneys and our staff to represent? How do we want our day-to-day to be there? And once we kind of solidified the culture that we wanted and the core values, that has really translated into virtually every decision we've made. Every hiring decision, yes, we look at resumes, yes, we look at experience and everything else, but it comes back to, do they fit the firm's culture? Do they fit the firm's core values? So I think it's a lot more than profits and scaling and growth. It's what do you want your business to represent? And to Ben's point at the beginning, if you want your business to be, you're a sole practitioner and you're not looking to scale, you're looking to just provide good services under your own umbrella, great. But what do you want those services to be? What's your niche going to be? Are you going to try and go head to head with a Goodwin Proctor as a sole practitioner? You're probably going to lose. So what's your niche? What's your value that you're going to add to those clients? And to be able to make those decisions and look at them internally, long answer to your question, I apologize. It's more than profits. It's more than scaling. It's developing the business that you want to be in every day.
You moved into topic 8, hiring for values and reinforcing the culture. So I think we should cover that because we're going to run out of time to cover everything. But so I would say, first of all, we have to be practical about it. You have to get to a certain size and scale and revenue before you can afford to hire somebody full time as a chief operating officer. That's not available to everybody. And I don't recommend that if you're a 1 or 2 lawyer firm with a couple of staff. But what happened for us was, we got to the, when you start an entrepreneurial endeavor, at the beginning, you're doing everything. You're wearing all the hats. And that's my partner, Taylor, and I were doing that initially. We were doing the finance. We were doing the HR. We were doing the legal services. We were doing the marketing, all of it. And what we found as we grew over time was we weren't capable of doing all of those things, and at least, or doing them very well. And so there got to be a point where our highest and best use was no longer, for example, doing HR. What happens is, and I think, and this goes to the core values point in topic 8 and the culture, we kept running into growth problems and ceilings in our business because of internal conflict and culture. We would have staff that were not fully bought into our mission in certain ways. There was internal conflict at times between staff. It made for a difficult environment. My partner and I would then get into policing internal disputes where someone would come to me with a criticism or complaint, and then they would go to my partner, and there would be so just got to be that navigating the people part of the business became emotionally draining and distracting. And having us, once we got to a certain scale of people, more than a dozen employees, that became an overwhelming problem and one that was distracting us from our mission. So hiring Jeff allowed us to offload that. I think the thing that Jeff brings to our organization more than any other single value is that he's extremely good at interpersonal relationships and making everyone on our team feel 100% supported and valued and bringing out the best in everyone. And since Jeff has come, we've had some people that didn't fit into our culture that left and had to leave. And we've hired many new people, and we've been very careful about vetting people to make sure they are a good cultural fit so we don't go back to a world where we have internal conflict. But I think anybody who runs a business would probably agree that the people part of the business is the hardest part. And particularly when you're dealing with law firms, because lawyers tend to have very big egos. And
no.
Not present company, but... I mean, the reality is law firms generally, and I started my career at a big firm in New York City, then I was at a relatively good sized firm in Maine, and then started my own firm. So I've seen it at all different levels. Law firms tend to have a model where there's two sets of rules, one that lawyers get to play by, and then one that everybody else gets to play by. Of course, the staff sees that right away, that they have to follow the rules, but the lawyers don't. And that already creates a toxic internal culture, if you ask me. Secondly, you then tolerate people because let's say they're good rainmakers or they're very exceptional at their craft of practicing law, but they're like, frankly, assholes, or they treat the staff poorly, or they don't represent your firm to the external world in a positive way that you want, but they're generating a lot of revenue. And most firms tolerate that because, you know, the bottom line is revenue. If you value culture, you don't tolerate that. And I should say, we have one of our core values, and we talk about core values is one of our things here, is making decisions based on science and data, not fear or ego. And we have incorporated science and data into our hiring process. When we hired Jeff, every candidate for his position took a psychological test. All of our leadership team took that same test. It was extremely valuable in identifying characteristics of people that you might want or not want. And it's surprisingly difficult to ascertain that through just like a typical interview process. We've now created a tailored psychological profile for a trial lawyer that we had the company make just for us, that we are now able to use to get science and data before we hire a lawyer for our firm. And that if anyone's looking for a job, we're hiring, but but you have to pass the psychological test first, which means you can deal with Jeff mostly. So you want to move on to another topic here?
Yeah, we're all over the map, but yeah. It's good.
Well, we covered topic 8 now. It's
all right. So we've done 1 and 8. So we only got 8 more. It's good. It's exactly how I knew this would go. Number 2, treat business decisions with the same rigor as legal decisions. What do you mean by that?
This one's very simple, and I think it's something that gives me confidence in building a business because as lawyers, we're all really good at doing analytical work and problem solving. That's, after all, that's what lawyers are, that's what we're there for, right? Clients, whatever they're transactional, commercial, criminal defense, whatever, somebody comes to you for a problem, you help them solve it. And fundamentally, that's all running a business is. It's a different set of problems. But the issue is that I found is that as lawyers, we employ a lot of rigor when it comes to solving the problems for our clients in the legal setting. But then when it comes to running the business part of what we're doing, we don't employ the same amount of rigor. So we've tried to impose those kind of systems of rigor onto our business decision part of the business, in addition to the trial part. It's been really great because that's what I'm used to anyway. For every case I do, I impose that kind of rigor. So it's very natural to do it in the business setting. And some examples of that are, there have been a lot of really bad decisions we've almost made.
Yes.
We've made some really bad decisions, but we've also avoided making some because we have a system for decision making, which involves multiple people that all have strong personalities and points of view that weigh in. So there's a vetting process where if Ben has an idea, it doesn't within, 24 hours translate into execution. There's a process that's discussed, vetted, and then decided upon by smart people that are all willing to speak their mind. Part of that is having people that are willing to speak their mind. So one of our values is, truth and communication, openness and transparency, as Jeff said. I come up with a terrible idea. Hopefully Jeff will tell me, Ben, that's a really bad idea. And that has led to a lot of near misses, I would say, where, we were about to buy very expensive buildings or hire people that we shouldn't have hired, or, you can go down the list of things where we made bad decisions. That more or less covers that topic. I mean, the books that I cite there, Ray Dalio, Principles, great, great book that talks a lot about this and the need to confront reality where it is, to be very honest about the reality that you're dealing with and not characterize the reality in the way that you want it to be. You have to deal with reality as it is. Second book there, the Daniel Kahneman book, Thinking Fast and Slow, that's all about cognitive bias. And we all make so many decisions, not even aware of it, based on cognitive bias, whether it's groupthink, because everybody's thinking the same thing and you're not having a contrary position, or a bias towards a risk aversion, or the bias towards sunk cost fallacy, where you started down a path and you continue down the path because you've already invested in it without realizing you're just putting good money in after bad. So many things like that that affect decision making have to be avoided to make the best decisions. So do you want to add to topic two about decision making?
No, there's a great quote that I try and abide by when it comes to decision making. John Wooden, the legendary basketball coach at UCLA, said, "Be quick, but don't hurry." There's a lot of truth to that, where you have so many decisions every day, whether you're trying a case or whether you're running your business, that you need to be decisive and you need to be focused, but be quick, but don't hurry, because hurried decisions usually lead to bad decisions. We try and avoid that wherever we can, and we put things in place, like Ben said, internally to avoid it. We're going to make bad decisions, but we have metrics and processes to minimize those as much as possible.
Yeah, and that's a good segue to topic three, design before you execute, but don't over-engineer early. So there's a good quote I've heard from many sources. I don't know who quoted it initially, but something to the effect of, if you have no plan, you'll certainly get there. That's really been a driving force for us. When Taylor and I started this firm, before we even began, we sat down, we wrote a business plan. And it's really apocryphal, because if you look back at that plan, even our year-to-year revenue goals, we literally met them, within a short range of $50,000, $100,000 year to year, which just demonstrates the power of having a goal and having a clear idea of what you're setting out to accomplish. But the concept of don't over-engineer, I don't know if any of you are familiar with the lean startup concept. This is sort of the stuff that, is very hot in Silicon Valley, with especially tech startups, AI startups. There's an author named Eric Ries who wrote that, Lean Startup. But the concept is minimal viable product now. This is how tech startups and software companies work. And the idea is that you don't want to spend an inordinate amount of time early on in design, because without having enough feedback to understand if your design is really salient to your consumer, to the public and the market. So what you want to do is put out, and this is the software concept, you put out the minimum viable product and then you iterate. You're constantly refining, you're constantly improving with feedback. And so that's what we've tried to do in our, you know, in our service sector type of business. We don't want to get paralyzed by trying to design the perfect system. We want to design something that we want to have large vision and goals, and then just start moving forward on that, and then getting feedback loops to help us iterate. I mean, one example is we recently launched a television radio ad campaign. We've never done that before. I've been doing this for almost 25 years and have never done direct-to-consumer marketing. Now, how do we do that? What's the perfect ad campaign? You could spend years designing a perfect campaign, where there probably is no definition of perfect. We used our core value of science and data, so we designed a messaging campaign. We actually did survey data where we put that out there and compared it to other competitors on the market and got real world information for that. 70% of the people who took the survey said they would hire us based on our messaging compared to our competitor commercials, if they were only basing their decision, their buying decision on the commercial. So, you know, that was some data point. It wasn't a ton of data, but it was good enough. Then we launched it, and now we have a feedback loop. So every client who contacts our office, our staff takes very detailed information about how they found us, what they're looking for lawyers, what the characteristics are in a lawyer that they want to hire, all of that. And that we have a our marketing director, Matt, over there is shaking his head. And he's fantastic, by the way. But so now we're iterating. We've got a feedback loop. We've got data, and we can make smart decisions on that. We could have spent years designing the perfect campaign, and we still wouldn't be doing anything right now. So that's just one example of that concept. So understanding the topic four, understanding which risks to take and which to avoid. This is kind of risk management. I've got a spiel on that, but I'm interested. If there's one main difference, I would say, between banking and trial law on the plaintiff side, it's going from a highly risk-averse culture to a highly risk-tolerant culture, right?
Take your playbook to the next level by joining a legal network of all-stars at psrplaybook.com. PSRPlaybook.com is a free digital legal library created exclusively for plaintiff lawyers by the nationally recognized personal injury law firm of Panish Shea Ravipudi LLP, and features video content showcasing the tactics, strategies, and concepts implemented by some of the industry's most successful trial attorneys. PSRPlaybook.com promotes learning, shared knowledge, collaboration, and best practices. Get in the game and see for yourself by joining our national network of plaintiff lawyers. Subscribe now at psrplaybook.com and learn from the best.
So how? What have you noticed about that, Jeff?
I mean, to a certain extent, but at the end of the day, there were so many parallels to banking, because you assess the risks of a case and you look and you see maybe what the insurance caps are. And if you take it to trial, you might get X number of dollars. If you settle it, you're going to get X number of dollars. What's right for the client? What's right for the firm? How long is it going to take? How much case costs are you going to carry for 2 or 3 years before it settles? So you're assessing your risk virtually every day with your cases. And it's the same thing on the bank side. I mean, especially on the lending side, you could do a $40 million loan for a commercial customer, but what's your risk and how are you going to hedge it? And so there's a lot of parallels to it. And I think every firm has to make a decision, or there has to be tactical times when you want to take risk and when it makes sense. And you have to be very clear on your risk tolerance as a firm, but also on a case-by-case basis, which I'm sure is what you're going to lend your wisdom to.
I'm very interested in this concept of risk because it permeates everything we do. We always have to counsel clients on what are the risks of taking a case to trial versus settlement. in the past, you were always operating on very limited data because it was largely past history and intuition, which isn't notoriously unreliable. We now do big data studies on every significant case, which really in our practice is really every case. And that gives us at least more, it's not perfect, but it gives us more data we can work with in order to do this kind of risk assessment. I've read two books recently, which I think are phenomenal on the topic of risk. One is the Nate Silver book called On the Edge. I don't know if anyone here read that book. It's Nate Silver was known for 538, the political prognostication website. He's also a like quasi-professional poker player. So the book is kind of like talking about the risks involved in poker, how people in Silicon Valley with like kind of the startup culture evaluate risk, and then how the rest of the world looks at risk. And it's pretty fascinating. There's another book called The Black Swan by Nassim Taleb, which is also a take on risk. Like most things, there's inconsistent and contradictory concepts involved. The concept of this black swan is that there's a lot in the world that's inherently unpredictable, and yet most things that we deal with relating to risk, like if you're going to invest in the S&P 500 index, well, you're told that that's low risk. But it's not low risk when some macroeconomic force occurs that causes everybody to go down and lose their shirts, which happens more often than you'd expect, like once every decade, that basically happens. The concept he came up with, which made him very successful in financial investing, was you have to identify asymmetric opportunities for asymmetric returns where the unpredictability works in your favor and not against you. And there's no better world where that exists than trial law. Because when we tried a case recently where the offer on the table was $300,000 and our verdict was $25 million. So there's an opportunity for asymmetric returns. So that's a black swan working for you. Now, in another case we had recently, there was an offer in excess of $30 million on the table. We could have taken that case to trial, but if we did, the unpredictable result would have worked against us there, right? So the asymmetric return probably would have worked against us. So trying to figure out whatever your business is, where are those opportunities for asymmetric returns based on unpredictability that you can take advantage of and other people aren't seeing? And so we've really tried to do that. And it's always a challenge to identify where the tipping point is there. But I would say that, you know, back to that, so many decisions that we make are not based on objective criteria or expected value calculations of actual results. They're based on things like, I'm really worried that I won't be able to make payroll this month, or somebody told me about something that happened to them, so this is probably going to happen to me. Or like we said, I've already invested so much money into this, I have to keep going. Those are all the kind of cognitive biases or individual fears that cause you to make decisions that are not objectively maximizing your ability to manage risk. So we really have tried to reduce the number of decisions we make on those kind of anecdotal knee-jerk thinking. And one example is we've developed a very complex settlement matrix where, like Jeff was describing earlier, we can plug in there. You know, so we're thinking about advising our clients about the risk of settlement versus trial and or continuing down the path for a while before we settle or so other things. And I think lawyers often think about that as it's either A or B. But you're forgetting about things like, well, what's the opportunity cost? Because you're employing staff and resources to litigate this case, right? They could be spending time on something else that may have a higher upside. You're also forgetting about, so you think about the first order benefit of a settlement, money in the pocket of your client or money in the pocket of your law firm. But there's second order consequences. What is the social value of that public trial to getting the word out about certain conduct that your client wants to shine a light on? What is the downstream value to your law firm or the reputational value of winning a big verdict and getting the next big case because you've been willing to do that. If you're only looking at first order consequences and not second and third order consequences, you're missing a lot of, you know, the value in your decision-making process. So I'm going to, let's move on to the next. So that's topic.
That was
four. We've covered eight already. So we've got 15 minutes. Let's do topic five, financially unbreakable systems. You want to talk about that, Jeff? We were just ironically talking to our accountant about those kind of things this morning.
Oh, financially unbreakable systems.
Yeah.
So you kind of need money to do everything that we're doing. But along the lines of you want to build, I mean, and Ben puts it, financially unbreakable systems, but you have to try and look holistically at your firm. You can't look, although you're looking on a case-by-case basis, you have to look at, again, the second and third tiers of what your decisions are going to make. What's your cushion? How much do you want for a cushion at your firm and how your decisions are made from that? We spend a lot of time. We have a finance meeting every week. We met with our accounting firm an hour ago, right before we came into this meeting, to already project and plan ahead for 26 and quarterlies and everything else, and made some decisions as a group on how we're going to make the changes. But you have to be very deliberate. And I think part of that also is what is, and Ben alluded to it before, and it may deviate from this, but I think it all goes the same. But what is the best and highest use of your time? Because having Taylor Asen or Ben Gideon opening the mail or doing intake calls is not the highest or best use of their time. It's something that had to be done when the firm was first started because they didn't have the financial systems in place to have other people doing that. You can't run out and hire eight people when you first start unless maybe you're a trust fund person or something, or somebody's gifted you. And then your goals have to be centered around being financially viable and understanding. I mean, case costs is a perfect example, I think. We fund our case costs internally right now, and we talk, and it revisits probably every quarter. Should we finance these? Should we do this? Should we do that? Should we charge interest? Should we? And we throw around all these other things. But when Ben was talking about that matrix we put together, a big part of that is the carry cost of those case costs. And you have $500,000 worth of case costs that have been out there for 3 years, you better factor that into your decision. And when you have a pipeline of cases that are on your books that are getting to the point where those case costs and the experts are starting to ramp up, where are those funds coming from? And how is it going to be allocated appropriately? And having those systems in place to help drive your decisions is critical.
Yeah, I mean, the core insight in financially unbreakable systems is that durability is critical. If you can't survive, you're not going to accomplish anything else. So your first order of business has to be to build a strong foundation that allows you to survive. And that includes through weathering storms when not all of your projections come to fruition, where, I mean, we have to assume, everybody who knows me well knows that I've lost a lot of trials, and I lost a very big trial a year ago that we had a huge amount of money in and a huge offer on the table, and we were able to weather that storm, and it didn't really even impact our bottom line materially because we had a strong financial footing. If we didn't have that, a single case like that could have bankrupted our firm and meant we wouldn't have been around any longer to do our further cases. So you've got to earn, you know, I feel like you've got to earn the right for that. If I want to go try a case, I've got to earn the right to do it by making sure I'm doing it from a position of strength, not I need to win that case. If I go into trial and I need to win, it's going to be desperate. It's like when you need to have a date and you're going up to every girl in the bar to asking her for a number. There's a smell of desperation that everyone can sense, and you don't succeed in that setting. You have to be coming to it with a, I'm not talking from personal experience.
I just didn't know if you had firsthand experience with that.
But, and then anyway, that doesn't apply in the modern world with the internet anyway, but I've been married for 25 years. So I don't know how any of that works these days.
I think the other point there, and one
the other thing, point is we need a good HR person.
Which we have.
Right.
I'm the HR person as well.
Right.
But I think another point there, and we talk about it a lot when it comes back to culture and core values, is you can't make case decisions based on your finances because they're going to be bad decisions. And what I mean by that is you decide to settle a case maybe prematurely because, you know, it'd be nice for that firm to get that $700,000 in the bank. And you can't put your clients in that position and you can't have your firm in that position and building that financial durability so you never have to make that decision is critical.
All right, moving on. Topic six, dominate a niche instead of fighting market leaders. So one of my favorite books on that is Seth Godin has written a lot of books on marketing. The one I thought was the best is called This Is Marketing. His sort of core insight is that your initial foray when you're starting any kind of an entrepreneurial venture is to identify the smallest viable market. Because by identifying the smallest market for your services, what you're doing is mapping what you do best, what you bring your highest and best value to a niche that is going to benefit from that service, right? So if you were starting a small firm, going head to head with Pierce Atwood and being a full service, you know, law firm that offers M&A and bankruptcy and whatever, immigration, so forth, you're not going to compete effectively with Pierce Atwood doing that, right? But if you are really good at one niche thing and can make a name for yourself in that, you will grow rapidly by reputational value and word of mouth and so forth. And so we did that when we started our firm. We were very deliberate about focusing like a laser on we are the best at doing complex medical malpractice cases. And for the first several years, I would say the lion's share of our new cases were in the field of medical malpractice. It's a good niche because very few lawyers want to do those cases. They're expensive. They're complicated. There isn't a lot of room for mistakes there because you can quickly lose your shirt on them and so forth. So we did that. And, you know, all of our marketing was very targeted on that. We would write articles focused on that. We wanted to establish kind of industry leaders in that area. And I think that was very effective for us. Since then, we've now expanded out into other areas of kind of complex civil litigation and personal injury cases beyond that. But if we had tried to do that at the outset, I think we would have been much less successful at building our business because there's a million lawyers out there who want to do, you know, garden variety personal injury cases. So that's just one example. Whatever niche you're in, you want to simplify and narrow it to the thing you do the very best and then put all of your focus and eggs into that basket initially, develop those relationships, build that business, and then gradually concentric circle out from there. I think you'd be great to talk about, Jeff, building systems, metrics, and accountability.
We build a lot of systems, metrics, and accountability. So part of our strategic plan was we tried to narrow down and focus on what our biggest metrics and measurements are going to be. KPIs, key performance indicators, and there are so many different things that you could try and point to. And, you know, we've really narrowed it down to less than a handful of things that we think are the most important things to our firm. And then we back it up with data and we track it. And it goes back to, again, one of our core tenets that, you know, we try and do everything as data-driven as possible, which I think for attorneys, what I've learned is, you know, especially for trial attorneys, a lot of it is your past experience and your gut instinct and how you can react, you know, in real time and in front of a jury or given an opening or giving a closing. But those may serve you very well in that role, but they may not serve you great if you can't reel those things in and have the metrics. And one of our biggest KPIs is what we call qualified cases. And we look at it and we decided what we felt were qualified cases for our firm. What were cases that, to the niche part, you know, we weren't expanding beyond our reach. We had the expertise, we have the systems, and we have the ability to handle this case and add a lot of value to it. And we found out that in order for us to get qualified cases, we probably have to talk to anywhere between 500 and 1,000 potential clients to get those qualified cases. So everything else that we're doing is really trickling down from that KPI. If we have to talk to that many potential clients, how does that impact our marketing? How does that impact our intake team? How does that impact our onboarding team? How do we get the data so that we are more focused from a marketing standpoint, from an intake standpoint, to try and drive more qualified cases? So, I mean, Ben, I can kind of kick over to you.
And the other part of it is we try to do, we have a Monday meeting every meeting. So I don't know anybody here like run their business or follow the EOS model, Entrepreneurial Operating System. It was kind of discussed in this book called Traction by Gino Wickman, which I've listed here. But there's some different systems like that businesses, entrepreneurial businesses use. And we use many of the tenets of EOS in our company. Part of that is having regular meeting pulses. But one of those is we have a Monday meeting every week where everyone in the firm is there for the first hour of the meeting. We have a defined dashboard that lists out our KPIs and key performance indicators that apply to each different segment of our practice. So every week we're looking at what are the number of intakes that came in, how many phone calls were answered, how many cases were accepted, rejected, how many are in this category, how many are in this category, what is our, you know, settlements, revenues, how many case reviews were completed. So the thing about that is there's really at least one or two metrics that applies to every different department in our firm. So the intake department has metrics. The litigation teams have metrics. And it's a way to kind of impose some level of accountability, public accountability at the weekly meetings.
Public shaming.
And public shaming to some extent. Although we try to do it with good humor most of the time. So we do that. And that really drives everything we do. And those KPIs are not arbitrary. They were developed because they all track to something we're trying to accomplish in our mission. So as Jeff said, we need a certain number of qualified cases. For us, that's the key metric. Because for instance, if we looked at revenue in a plaintiff's firm goes like this, because you might have a big settlement and a big case. All of a sudden, your revenue looks really impressive, but that's not really an indicator of the health of your business because you may not have another case like that coming in the pipeline anytime soon, right? And so if you were basing your decisions only on revenue or your health of the business, that would not be a good indicator. So what we've come to is qualified cases, because we know if we have a certain number of qualified cases in our pipeline, that will translate into a certain number of revenue over a certain period of time. And whatever kind of practice you have, I think a good first step is to identify what are the 2 to 3 or 1 key metrics that you really want to track. And it's going to be different. You know, if we were an hourly rate practice, it would be a totally different metric.
Different.
So, and then the systems part is just having replicable systems that once you've figured out how to do something well, you continue to do it the same way every time and train people to do it that way. So you're not constantly reinventing the wheel and you have consistent high quality standards across the board. And when we started, we would have multiple paralegals and they would all be doing things their own individual ways, you know, and one way would be better and the other way would be worse. And at some point it occurred to us, well, why don't we just taking the best practice and having everyone do it that way. So we've really tried to do that across the board and, you know, systems that define what we're doing. So we covered 8. Let's move quickly on to 9 in our last 3 minutes and we'll cover 10.
9, scale without diluting identity or quality. This is kind of the stage we're at right now, Ben. We've laid our foundation. We had a fantastic year last year and now we're in our scaling phase. What's our next step? We're filling out our litigation team. We're increasing our marketing. We're increasing our intakes. How do we scale without losing all the things that we've put in place that have been successful up to this point? And a lot of that is very simple things, but the service you try and give every potential client that calls in, if we all of a sudden go from 60 intakes a week to 250 intakes a week, are we going to lose that personal touch? Are we going to lose that ability to be able to decipher on whether it's an appropriate or qualified case, or can we refer it out to another attorney? So to be able to scale and not lose your culture, not lose what made you successful to begin with, I don't want to say is what we're struggling in, but that's this year for us. That is 2026. And we're 3 weeks into it. And
for me, this is very personal to me because I'm getting older as the days and years go by. And there comes a point where I want to do less. I want to have a firm where the firm isn't about the individuals. It's about having the firm, and the firm comes first. And we have a powerhouse firm, not just people that have good, reputations. And so I no longer do most of the legal work on most of the cases, which I did for years. I've very intentionally taken myself out of, I'm not lead counsel on any case in our office now, which I love. It doesn't mean I'm not intimately involved in every case. I am, just in a different way. But that's been critical to scaling. In order to scale, it's self-evident, but you have to take yourself out of being indispensable for everything. Otherwise, you can't scale. You have limited amount of time. You have limited time horizons. So, there's things where I can add value and strategy and input into some of the critical junctures in cases. I'm still going to probably be first chair in every trial we do for the foreseeable future, which I'm happy and excited to do. But if I don't take another deposition in my lifetime, I'll be very happy. I'm doing two next week. But I the reality is I'll still do a few, but I'm for the most part not doing depositions, not doing the briefs. And I'm trying to take myself out of most of that.
This is how I know we're on the right track. It's very easy for the Bens and Taylors of the world to give up things that they don't enjoy. They gave up facilities and buying office furniture. They gave up dealing with our IT vendor.
Taylor really enjoyed the office furniture.
He did. I had to pry it away from him, that's because he likes a good deal.
Right.
We hired a marketing person and brought him in-house, so they gave up marketing. So all those things were the easy things for them to give up. The hard things, and I know we're on the right path because Ben and Taylor are starting to give up things that they've been doing for the last two decades and been doing very well. And they have the confidence in the team that we've built to hand over those duties that in the past if I want it done right, I got to do it myself. And so that's the exact trajectory we want to be on. And I don't know, it's good.
So we sort of at the end, but let me just comment on the very last topic. One of our goals, in addition to our financial goals and client services related goals, is we actually have an internal goal. We call it building the law firm of the future. And I think, we all probably use AI in different capacities currently. I am a huge user of AI. I'm probably on ChatGPT, much to my wife's dismay, 5 hours a day, but it has enormous power to leverage what we currently do and to make us more efficient and productive. It also has the power to distract and be useless. So we have to use it in a very deliberate and intentional way. But I think it's fair to say that what a law firm looks like even 2 or 3 years from now, let alone 5 or 10 years from now, is going to be totally different. There will no longer be teams of people answering phone calls. That will almost certainly all be handled by AI. A lot of the things that paralegals currently do will be done by AI. A lot of things that young associates, in our medical malpractice cases, getting a lawyer competent to review a complex medical record and make decisions about even whether that is or isn't the case would take years in the past and hours or days of time. It can be done for the most part in about an hour now, utilizing AI and training somebody on how to issue spot through that process. So there's just so many ways in which whatever industry you're in or practice, AI is going to revolutionize it. I think in terms of being a law firm owner and a leader, the goal now is to start building your practice with that in mind, not to use AI to substitute for anything right now, but to be thinking about how that might be done in the future and creating systems that will enable you to do that as the time becomes ripe for it. So we could talk a lot more about that, but we were out of time. So with that, as we said at the outset, we'd love to have anybody who has a thought or questions or wants to continue the conversation, feel free to come up. You can use this mic. You can join us on the podcast if you want. Otherwise, it was great to see everybody. I hope you enjoyed the conference. Rachel, thank you for inviting us. Have a nice day.
Did we rise to the challenge today? If so, tell a friend. If not, tell us what would make the podcast more valuable to you. Thanks for spending your valuable time with us today. And remember, when we elevate people and we elevate practices, we elevate the profession. Produced and powered by LawPods.